Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Robert Huber ends his cover story in the March edition of Philadelphia Magazine, Being White in Philly, with this plea. We need to bridge the conversation divide so that there are no longer two private dialogues in Philadelphia, white people talking to other whites and black people to blacks, but in a city in which it is okay to speak openly about race. Instead of a conversation about race, the article has become a critique of Philadelphia Magazine. With its all-white editorial staff, the article's use of anonymous sources, the depiction of African Americans as criminals or unemployed or drug dealers or takers, if you will. Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter condemned the article and has called on the Human Relations Commission to look into whether it was the equivalent of shouting fire in a theater. Robert Huber and editor Tom McGrath were criticized at two forums in the city last week, and the story has made national news, and they both join us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Tom McGrath, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And Bob Huber, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Marty.
Tom, let me begin with you. Are you surprised that this article has gotten not just a response, but such a negative response?
Anytime you write about race, you know that you're going to touch on a controversial subject. I think Bob has the line in the story that says something about talking about race is sort of like touching the third rail. So I'm not necessarily surprised. I guess the volume of the criticism I'm a little bit surprised over. But we put it out there. So,
and why did you put it out there? As you said in the very beginning of the magazine, as you wrote about why you wrote the story, you said it's a story, and it's a story that needs to be told. How come?
Well, I think this goes back to the fact that, you know, we're half a century past the height of the civil rights movement, and Philadelphia remains a fairly segregated city, which I think would have surprised people 50 years ago at the height of the civil rights movement. And it's not just that we live largely separately, but I think the fact that there's inequality that remains. There's a lot of poverty in Philadelphia, and it tends to be more among African Americans and other people of color than it does among white people. And so this felt like a way to sort of get at that conversation, because despite those big problems, this isn't talked about very much.
Well, Bob, let me go to you. And you wrote this article and begin the article saying that you have a son who attends Temple University.
I do.
And you live in Mount Airy, a section of Philadelphia as well. And it was the going back and forth between these two neighborhoods that got you thinking about this article.
My thinking really did begin there. As you mentioned, Marty, the piece begins talking about my son going to Temple. And as I went and visited Nick, he lives about five blocks west of Broad there at Temple, I began thinking more and more about the neighborhood he lives in, and that it's a struggling neighborhood. And I began thinking about how it's a neighborhood, it seems to me, as I thought about it, that whites largely ignore, or that they would rather even that it doesn't exist. And that immediately brings up issues of race, because that neighborhood, like many of our struggling neighborhoods, is largely African American. But as Tom is saying, there's not much dialogue about race between the races in Philadelphia. Essentially, whites talking to whites, blacks talking to blacks, and we remain a largely segregated city. So this is how my thinking was sort of building about this. The other part of it is that whites often are unwilling or afraid to speak their minds or feel that they can't.
As you write, afraid of being called racists.
Afraid of being called racists. There are many, many unwritten rules about racial dialogue, including not talking about it often, it seems to me. So I wanted to take a look at how white people relate to black people in the inner city. And out of that idea came what we did, which was go to a white neighborhood near a largely African-American one, get the beat of life there, get a sense and a feel of what people are thinking, and that landed me in Fairmount near Girard Avenue, where north of Girard Avenue, Brewery Town is a neighborhood largely African-American with problems of poverty and so forth.
What you found, and it's curious, and I don't exactly understand why people, the white people quoted in this article, are anonymous. Did they not want to give you their names? Did they ask for anonymity? You either make up a name or just give us a first name.
Well, I started there because what I really wanted more than anything else was people to speak their minds to me, tell me what they were thinking, how they were engaging people in their community, especially black people. And it seemed to me, out of the chute, I was going to get people to speak openly if they didn't feel they were ID'd. So I asked for first names and cell phone numbers. Everybody gave me both in-house. We had a fact checker who went back and checked and verified and so forth.
Let me go back to you, Tom, and I'm looking at the very cover. The covers. This is a cover story. First of all, why was this a cover story for the magazine?
Well, because
Which obviously saying this is a really important story.
Sure. Yeah, we thought it was a really important topic when it in Philadelphia, and again, it's not something that's talked about very often. So that was interesting. I also thought there would be a large level of interest in it. I mean, this is a topic that people do feel passionately about. So it seemed to me to make sense on a couple fronts to put it on the cover.
You both have said that white people don't talk about race or don't talk about race with black people. That's not my experience, I have to say. And so I'm curious about where that comes from, Tom. I mean, where that perspective comes from. White people and black people don't talk about race together.
Well, I think, I mean, I would just use my own life as an example. I think, you know, I rarely talk about race, not just with black people, but even with white people. It's just not a subject that seems to come up in my own life. We had some staff discussions about this story at the very beginning of the process, and I think that was, I'm not saying it was 100% consensus on that, but I think there was some nodding heads as that point was mentioned.
Well, and I should say, Bob, as you describe your neighborhood, you live in Mount Airy. You live in a diverse street, it sounds like.
I do.
With African-American neighbors. Do you talk with your neighbors about race?
I don't talk to them about race, no. I certainly, they're very friendly. It's a wonderful street. We certainly talk. We don't talk about race.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's because it's a very difficult topic for whites and blacks to talk to each other about. I think at a certain level of friendship, it's possible, a deep level of friendship. But for the most part, we edge around it or don't talk about it.
Again, I'm looking at the cover, Tom, and it says, in a city that is largely poor and segregated, white people have become afraid to say anything at all about race. Here's what's not being said. And what's not being said is that African Americans are criminals or would-be criminals. They're pot smokers. They're pot dealers or drug dealers. The depiction of African Americans in this article is that they're part of a criminal element.
Well, I think there are certainly some people that Bob talked to in the story that frame African Americans that way. But I actually think there are a number of different points of view among the white people that Bob spoke to within the story. So on the one hand, there's obviously lots of bigotry. But on the other hand, there's lots of people who have enormous amount of empathy and a willingness and a real desire to sort of go forward on this. And so I don't think this is just completely a negative depiction of African Americans at all.
Well, let me just quote from the article here. And Bob, you describe a woman named Anna, a tall, slim, dark-haired beauty from Moscow, getting out of her BMW on an alley just south of Girard College. And here's part of what she says. Blacks use skin color as an excuse. Discrimination is an excuse instead of moving forward. It's a shame. You pay taxes. They're not doing anything except sitting on porches smoking pot. Why do you support them when they won't work? Just make babies and smoking pot. Mm-hmm. What I don't see in this article is you challenging her perspective on that.
Well, what I wanted to do is talk to as many people as I could in probably 15 visits to Fairmount. What they said is what they said, and I wanted to build the article and let the article work based on these voices, based on what I learned, based on their experiences, and I didn't think it called for me to come in and weigh in. Now, I happen to think personally that what she said is racist and offensive, but I think it stands on its own in that way.
But and here's a quote in preparation for the show. I'm not sure whether you said this in the article or whether you said it in a couple of the forums that you were at. I wanted to put their feet to the fire. The idea is that you wanted to put these people's feet to the fire, these people that you interview. But in that particular section, you don't put her feet to the fire.
Well, I think her quote stands for itself, as I just said. I mean, I think it's offensive on the face of it. What I was really looking for is not white people saying racist things as much as white people who had an engagement in some way with that community. And I think in various ways with other anecdotes, I do hold people's feet to the fire. For example, there's a long section about Jen, who's a mother of, she has two elementary school children, and she was determined to send her children to Bosch Martin, the local elementary school. And really that section is about Jen trying to convince other parents, other white parents in Fairmount, that we can send our children to this really good neighborhood school, which is 74% African American. We don't have to send them down to Rittenhouse, which is less African American. And frankly, I think that is certainly holding white people's feet to the fire. I think Jen's fellow parents come off looking nervous and scared, mm-hmm. and they have to be sort of dragged kicking and screaming. So that's one example of where I'm holding feet to the fire.
Well, Tom, let me go back to you. I mean, do you think in hindsight that Bob should have been more overtly and in print critical of these comments that we were just talking about? And what do you think about the use of anonymous sources?
Well, just in terms of you know, we would have done anything differently. It certainly would have been helpful. The perception is out there that somehow these were all Bob's views, which is certainly not the case, as mm-hmm. Bob said. So I think, it probably would have been smarter for us if Bob had some lines in there, you know, saying this is not a view that he personally holds. As I said, every story that we do has some flaws in it, and this one is not any different. And I think the flaws in this one have probably been amplified just given the stakes. In terms of the anonymous sources, most news organizations or most publications use anonymous sources at various times. We don't have a hard and fast rule about it. It comes down to a case-by-case basis where is there a legitimate reason that the person would be anonymous? And as Bob explained, I thought in this case, there was a legitimate reason. We wanted these people to speak as candidly as possible. And if we were going to put their full names on there, they probably were not going to do that.
But do you think that by using anonymous sources, it raises questions about whether you want to have an honest conversation about race? I mean, if people are going to be anonymous, can we have an honest conversation about race?
Well, I think it's honest in the sense that these people are clearly being very, very candid about what they think. And I think if we're going to have the conversation, if somebody's going to censor themselves or not say exactly what they're thinking, I don't know how that moves anything forward.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree. The goal here is to get people candidly speaking. And frankly, I have to admit, I'm a little surprised. You and other people have asked about the anonymous sources. Mm-hmm. I don't see that it makes a huge difference whether you're learning just a first name or a first and last name of a source. You believe in what's being said by people based on the seeming credibility of how it's written and the voice of the piece. It works or it doesn't.
Well, and I guess the criticism is that because of the anonymous sources and I guess your ambiguous or what people perceive as your ambiguous point of view, that has raised questions about the use of anonymous sources.
Yeah, I understand it's raised questions, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about a Philadelphia Magazine cover story that's gotten a lot of coverage itself. And the cover story says Being White in Philly. It's the March edition of Philadelphia Magazine. Talking with Tom McGrath, he's the editor of Philadelphia Magazine, also with Bob Huber, who wrote the piece, and both of them joining us here on Radio Times, as they have at other forums in Philadelphia talking about this article. We want to hear from you. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. No composer ever expressed such aching sorrow, ever captured the agony of the crucifixion as did Johann Sebastian Bach. Yannick Nezet-Séguin, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and choruses perform Bach's St. Matthew Passion. Tickets at 215-893-1999. Online at philorc.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, the St. Matthew Passion of Johann Sebastian Bach.
The budgetary discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet, at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY in the last 5 years has offset government losses, yet resulted in the growth of the services you rely on. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org to make a donation.
The Chester County Historical Society supports WHYY and presents the 31st Annual Chester County Antiques Show, Friday, April 5th through Sunday, April 7th at the Phelps School in Malvern, PA. More than 50 exhibitors feature 18th and 19th century American and continental furniture, rugs, paintings, glass, silver, jewelry, needlework, and other decorative arts. Presented by PICO. For details on tickets, show hours, and sponsorship opportunities, 610-692-4800 or chestercohistorical.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Tom McGrath about a cover story of Philadelphia Magazine. He's the editor at that magazine. It's called, the cover story is Being White in Philly, written by our other guest, Bob Huber. And in the article, Bob interviews a number of whites living in the Fairmount section of Philadelphia about some of their poor black neighbors in North Philadelphia. And as you probably know by now, the article has gotten a, shall we say, firestorm of response. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Bob, let me just go back to you, because I think the difficulty with anonymous sources and also with anecdotes is that it's possible to find an anecdote to prove anything.
Right.
I mean, that's, you know, you can prove the world is flat through an anecdote. And to build, I guess, an article around a series of anecdotes, raise questions about, I guess, the veracity of what's in the article itself.
Right. Sure. Especially a topic like race, you can find somebody to say absolutely anything. Right. And if a writer's going into an article with a specific agenda of what he wants people to say, he can find it and find them to say that. My agenda, as it were, was to find white people's engagement with their black neighbors. That's what I was looking for, and I was looking for the most interesting and telling stories that told me about that, so I could learn something about that and convey that to a reader. Now, there's, you know, a relationship you have with a reader. They trust that you're a messenger of that in an honest way or not.
What did you learn? I mean, in writing this article, I guess in the reaction to the article, what have you learned?
Well, I think I've learned a couple of things. One is I did certainly meet and talk to a lot of people in Fairmont who have very involved and fairly complicated relationships with their neighbors, and that was really interesting. That didn't surprise me, but learning them was really interesting. Certainly the reaction has surprised me a little bit. I knew there would be pushback and reaction and so forth writing about race. But just how tender that nerve is for so many people has really, really been striking.
Tom, I was at the forum across the street at the National Constitution Center last Friday, and you were criticized for having an all-white editorial staff, which Philadelphia Magazine does. And one of the critics said, you know, you're the wrong messenger. If we're going to talk about race, Philadelphia Magazine should not be the messenger. Do you think there's some truth to that or not?
Not necessarily. I mean, we certainly talked in-house while the story was still being discussed about whether or not we sort of have the license to do this, given the fact that we have no people of color on our staff. And at the end of the day, I just thought, like, there really shouldn't be any topics that are off the table for us. I mean, as long as we're sort of transparent about everything, and I think in this case, we were. So, no, I don't think that should have disqualified us in any way.
Well, I think it's interesting. A couple of the writers for Philadelphia Magazine have criticized this piece. In fact, one said, don't read this piece. Does that tell us something about some of the, I guess, the debate that's been going on inside the magazine about this cover story?
Sure, yeah. I mean, every month when our issue comes out, we all gather as a staff to sort of review this whole thing. And we did this immediately after the March issue came out a few weeks ago. And the room was fairly unanimous in terms of not liking the story at all. Right. And so I took the step to sort of give our website over to folks who wanted to express what they didn't like about the story, and several of them took me up on it.
Are you going to do a response to this cover story? I mean, is this an issue you're going to follow?
In some way. We haven't nailed down exactly yet what the next step is on this. I think what I'm looking for is sort of the next interesting step. Our goal throughout this has always been to sort of, let's create more conversation about an important issue in Philadelphia. So I want to take some time and sort of think through what is the next step that really takes us forward here.
Are you going to hire more or an individual minority staffer? I mean, is that on your goal list?
Absolutely. You know, I've said in the last couple of weeks that it's something I've committed to, and just because I think it's for the good of the magazine. I think, you know, writers always bring different perspectives with them. You know, Bob brings one perspective, other staff writers bring other perspectives. So I think it would make the magazine richer if we had more people of color involved in what we do. But it's a complicated issue. You know, that this is something that it's an issue not just for the magazine, our magazine in general, but magazines in general and lots of other publications as well.
And you can correct me if I'm wrong here. The view is that your readership is largely white, well-heeled or relatively well-heeled and suburban. Is that a pretty good description of your demographic?
The demographic, the way we talk about it, is that we're writing for the most educated and also the most affluent people in the not just the city, but the region in general. The way it breaks down city and suburbs is, I think, something about between 60 and 65% of our readers are in the suburbs. The rest are in the city. I actually don't even know what the racial breakdown is.
Let me go back to you, Bob, and then I do want to get to some callers here, because one of the things you write in towards the end of your article, that you wanted the freedom to speak to my African-American neighbors about how the inner city needs to get its act together. I'm quoting you there. Mm-hmm. Have you talked to your African-American neighbors since this article has come out?
Not very much. One of the problems is the weather has been really lousy and people are not out and about, because most of these conversations take place outside. People are working their yards or hanging out on porches, and we stop by and chat. I'm assuming that'll gear up as the weather turns. And we'll see. I would welcome and hope to have conversations like that with my neighbors.
But about how the inner city needs to get its act together. I mean, let's imagine it actually is springtime and people are outside. I mean, what do you want to talk to your neighbors about? About the inner city.
Well, if I have a conversation with a neighbor about my son going to Temple, I mean, that might naturally segue to the neighborhood he lives in. That might naturally segue into what's going on in inner city Philadelphia and certain struggles, and how can things get better? What can we do about it? A conversation about that. And I think that certainly begins to get into a conversation about race, you know, because so many of these neighborhoods are populated by African Americans. So I would hope to and welcome those conversations and see where they go.
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've really learned in the last couple of weeks as there's been this reaction to the story is just how little trust there is on sort of all sides of this issue. And because of that, it's just really, really hard to have any kind of conversation about it at all, whether it's in a public forum or even whether it is sitting down with your neighbor and, you know, talking as they're working in their garden. Because I think people are so quick to hear the worst or you know, assume the worst of a people, and it goes on both sides, I would say.
Well, and part of this article, I think, feeds some of that worst. That's certainly what Mayor Nutter was criticizing, that the African Americans in this article, again, come across as slackers, pot smokers, drug dealers, you know, criminals.
Well, I don't think that's completely true, Marty. And one of the things I was determined to do, and Tom and I were determined to do as we talk about it, is write about what people were really saying and what we found as I walked the Fairmont neighborhood. We weren't going to avoid people like Anna the Russian because she was saying racist things. It's explosive what she said, but she said it. And there are white people who hold that view. There are white people who hold all kinds of views. And the only way it seemed to us to do this piece was to get at real thinking as much as we can, real stories of how people are engaged, and not be nervous about, okay, how is this coming across? Is it offensive? Do we have to back up and say, hold on, folks, this is offensive. We don't share that view. I was determined not to do that, to forge ahead and say, this is who I talked to. This is what I found. And I understand that touched a nerve. And as Tom earlier said, maybe we should have backed up a little bit, you know, say with Anna the Russian, and say, look, this is offensive. We get that. But bare bones was very important here, because that's the conversation we're looking for, and that's what we feel white people are often afraid to have, and that's important.
But Tom, this also comes across as an article about class. You've got middle class white people living in a certain section of Philadelphia next to a section of Philadelphia largely inhabited by poor African Americans, and it seems to me that's as much of an issue as race.
Absolutely. There's no question that issues of race and class are very much intertwined. And Bob does make some references to class in there as well. I mean, this is obviously a complicated topic that you can look at from a number of different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And class is absolutely one of them.
But was this a publicity stunt? And by that, I mean that you wanted to cause a stir and get people talking about Philadelphia Magazine. And I mean, I know these interviews have been tough, and I frankly appreciate the fact that you're both here. But has this been sort of a way of getting attention for Philadelphia Magazine?
Marty, can I answer that?
Of course. Yes, go ahead, Bob. I'm looking at Tom, but go ahead, Bob.
You're looking at Tom.
I'd like to answer, too, but wait.
Yes,
ahead.
Indeed.
I mean, I'm a little offended by that, frankly. I mean, I went into this story with real passion for what I was seeing in North Philadelphia. And I, you know, I have spent time in these neighborhoods. I have written in the past, 2 or 3 years ago, I wrote a reported essay about poverty in the city. As much as the Inquirer called me old, an old white journalist.
There you go.
Can understand some issues of the inner city. I wrote a piece from that perspective. So I have been writing and thinking about this for some time, and I came at it with some passion of being upset at the struggles of the inner city and being upset with what I feel is a real lack of engagement of white middle-class Philadelphians and suburbanites. And I wanted to write something about that. I did feel a little angry. My anger is not at all directed at black people. My anger is directed at the state of a struggling inner city and in many ways not getting lives not getting better, and the state of engagement and our racial discussion. Those things I'm very passionate about.
Go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to say, I mean, I'm probably not smart enough to have come up with this kind of thing as a publicity stunt. I mean, you know, we put this out there because I thought it was an important issue, and you know, people reacted the way they've reacted. And I think if it was a publicity stunt, I mean, so much of the publicity has been negative.
Yes.
I'm not sure that it was a very effective publicity stunt, whether you had conceived it that way. So, no, but it absolutely was not a publicity stunt.
Well, there
stunt.
Is a theory that there's no such thing as bad publicity. I don't know if you ascribe to that or
I
not.
I can tell you, Marty, the last month of criticism, while I wrote the piece, I'm a big boy, I can take it, has not been great fun. So if I wrote this trying to say, I'm out here, no, that would have been pretty silly.
Well, and I know at a forum last week, I'm not sure which of you or maybe both of you were called racists. And I know that's a very serious charge.
Right.
And I wonder to you, Tom, and then you, Bob, and then we will get to our callers. What you make of that charge? Do you think there's some truth to that? Have you been thinking about called a racist?
Is there any truth to it? No, of course not. But it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the lack of trust with this issue, that there are some people, and again, it's on both sides, that immediately assume the worst when something is said about this. And so, you know, look, the woman who said that to us or screamed that at us, actually, I mean, she's entitled to think what she thinks, but it's certainly not true.
What do you think, Bob?
It's almost an easy criticism because it's so absurd. I mean, I know what's in my heart and mind, so I don't want to hear that, but I also don't need to respond to it.
I also think, by the way, that it's a word that's designed to end a conversation, or at least it's become that once someone or something is dubbed racist, well, that's it, because nothing more can be said about it because it is such a dark, ugly word.
And that's a huge goal we have, that we get beyond. I mean, I know talking about this article is still front and center, but there's an important next step here, not about the article, but about, okay, can our conversation shift a bit? Can it get better? Can people be more open? I'm actually beginning to see a little bit about that, and that's where we want to get to. That's the point of the piece.
And that's Bob Huber, the author of the cover story in the March edition of Philadelphia Magazine, Being White in Philly. Also with us, Tom McGrath. He's the editor of Philadelphia Magazine. And not surprisingly, lots of people that want to join our conversation. Let's begin with, looks like, Dora from Powelton. And Dora, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I read your article word for word, and I found it appalling and disgusting. I live in an area in Powelton Village that sounds similar to the area that you live in. Yes, African-Americans and whites can live together. But I think you need to come outside and talk to your neighbors, not just when you're doing your garden, but when an issue like that, to see how they really feel. To me, it's screams of racism, entitlement, and this whole thing of elitist type attitude. And I really don't like the fact that you don't even get the fact that that is what this has portrayed to the African-American community.
Well, Dora, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Bob, let me give you a chance to respond.
Well, I would certainly welcome and love to have these conversations with my neighbors. As I've lived on my street for 4 years, I've gotten to know them better and better, and hopefully these conversations can get better and richer. I'm sorry you do feel this way about the article, that it screams entitlement and so forth.
Do you want to add to that, Tom?
Well, you know, one of the things I said at the Constitution Center last week was that it's become clear to us that this story has wounded a lot of people, and I'm actually very sorry about that. I don't regret having taken on the topic, but we were certainly not intending at all to hurt anyone's feelings or to wound people.
Well, and with that in mind, do you think it would have made sense to talk to some African Americans or to talk to Latinos or to the real true diversity of the city?
Well, we certainly talked about that as we were conceiving the story and ultimately decided not to because, again, we were trying to take on a really, really big topic here, but to just do it from a single point of view and to be as transparent about that as possible. So, we were trying to get what do white people think about the issues of race, and that's what we presented.
But do you think you captured the nuance, the whole complexity of how white people think about black people, Bob?
Of course not. It's 5,000 words is a spit in the ocean. It's far too complicated to say, I've got it. This is how white people in Philadelphia think about race. As somebody said in print, you know what? This was not a racial manifesto. It's a story. So it's a story that's trying to capture something of what white people in a given neighborhood say and think about race. And, you know, opening out to many people probably think along similar lines. But does it cover the topic? Mm-hmm. Of course not. It's an opening.
An opening. And you said in your description of this article in the beginning of the magazine that it's a story. By a story, what do you mean by that?
Well, again, that it's not a report on something filled with statistics and so forth. I mean, we never intended this to be a definitive report on the state of race relations in Philadelphia. As Bob said, it's a sort of look at one neighborhood, what white people in one neighborhood, what their experiences are with this topic. And to me, that is a sort of a story.
And there are two covers of this story, one that has gone to the general public and one that has gone to the hotels where people can read Philadelphia Magazine. What's on that cover?
That cover has a story about fashion in Philadelphia.
And, I mean, obviously you saw that as incendiary. I mean, the idea of this article with that cover in a hotel room might be incendiary.
This was a very practical decision that we made. We have about, overall circulation is about 115,000. We have about 5,000 copies that go into hotel rooms. In the past, when we've had some controversial cover stories, the hotels have just declined to put those magazines in the hotel rooms. So a couple years ago, we started doing, when we had a controversial cover, just sort of alternate covers that would go in the hotel room. Obviously, I knew that race was going to be a controversial topic. So in this case, I just said, let's put fashion on the one that's going to go into the hotel rooms and just approach it practically, honestly.
But was the article inside?
Yes, it was. The content on the inside is exactly the same.
But not on the cover.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And I do want to get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking with Robert Huber, Bob Huber, longtime Philadelphia Magazine writer, editor, author of the magazine's March cover story, Being White in Philly. He's also written for other magazines, including Esquire and GQ. Also with us is Tom McGrath. He's the editor of Philadelphia Magazine, a former executive editor of Men's Health Magazine, and former editor of Atlantic City Magazine. 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Arcadia University Summer Sessions supports WHYY. Summer sessions at Arcadia are designed to keep you ahead of your degree studies, enhance your professional knowledge, or introduce you to new topics. Online classroom and blended course options offered in accelerated formats in many disciplines at Arcadia's Glenside or King of Prussia campus. Registration is open now. Session 1 starts May 20th. Information and registration at arcadia.edu/summernow.
Psychologist Robert Nassif's new book, Autism in the Family, delivers his personal narrative as a father of a grown autistic son, as well as a comprehensive view of autism throughout the lifespan. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, I'm joined by Nassif to discuss how families of autistic children cope and care together. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
WHYY is a media sponsor for the Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University. offering its 2013-14 season of diverse ideas, world perspectives, and thought-provoking conversation. 7 engaging evenings at the Kimmel Center with a stellar lineup of speakers, including former Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, author Bill Bryson, Ambassador John Huntsman, and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Information at PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Tom McGrath and Bob Huber about the March edition of Philadelphia Magazine, the cover story being White in Philly. Let's see what Raul from Bella Vista has to say. Raul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say that I also looked over the article, too, and as a white person, I was horribly offended by it. As I live in the city, and I got to say, man, this was... I don't doubt your sincerities, either of you and the writers. I don't doubt the sincerity on getting a dialogue started, but I cannot believe that the tone and the perspective of this was not taken into consideration. And just my point is, and Marty, actually, you touched on it earlier, is that... I mean, of all the things, and there's so many things to talk about, like, just why is this even being framed in terms of race? Like, this term, I mean, there's such a divide in this article about white people and the white people experience and black people and the black people experience, and that's it. And even their experience isn't even really touched on, let's be honest. It's really primarily from the white, quote-unquote, white person's perspective. The socioeconomic factors involved here. Like, why is Philadelphia so segregated by race? Is it that we're a really racist society, or is it that there's something else at play here?
Well, Raul, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Tom McGrath a chance, and then I'm sure Bob, you want to weigh in as well.
Well, again, there's no question that socioeconomic factors are a huge part of this, but I think it's sort of naive to say that race is not part of it, at least in the way people perceive it, and also, honestly, in the causes of it. I mean, this is the result, in a lot of ways, of several centuries of oppression and legalized discrimination against African Americans. So to say that this is only about socioeconomic factors, I think it doesn't make sense to me. It's clearly about race as well.
Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I certainly agree with Tom. African Americans, certainly victims of 300-plus years of racism. Poverty is a huge factor in the plight of the inner city. And there's also a here and now relationship of one community to another. In this case, my little window, Fairmont and Brewery Town, essentially. And race does play into that. It plays into perceptions. It plays into how white people engage black people. So race is certainly a factor in that way, with all these underlying causes part of it as well.
Well, let me quote again from you. I'm doing a lot of that during the hour, Bob, but you describe one Fairmounter blames herself for her grill being stolen from her backyard because if you don't fence it in, she tells me, you're asking for it. A pumpkin gets lifted from her front stoop in the fall. She buys another. That one gets stolen. She gets in one more. It's called city living. Flower pots, even trash cans, they don't stick around. Porch chairs have to be chained together. Your car window is likely to get smashed every now and then. Mm-hmm. But the implication is, and you don't say this exactly, but the implication is that it's black people that are doing this.
It's written that way for a reason, because that is the perception of white people who live in Fairmont, that it is black people doing these things. Now, I do say, on the heels of that, is this all black guys from Brewery Town? Of course not. And I talked to a couple police officers in the neighborhood and asked them about it, and they do verify that, well, in large part, it is African Americans who are committing these, sort of nominal crimes. But perception with race is so powerful and so key, and I wanted to get at how white people perceive what's going on in their neighborhood. Mm.
But it almost sounds like perception as reality, if you know what I mean.
Well, I mean, that's why a couple of graphs later I'm saying, all this crime committed by black guys? No, not all of it.
Let me see what Rosemary from Jenkintown has to say. Rosemary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I'd like to bow down on my knees to these two men of the greatest courage to write an article about this, because I am a person of non-color. And deep down, all people of non-color in the United States, deep down, have the guilt of what we have done to people of color. And they care. Your two men of that Philadelphia magazine care enough to do this and to take all this stuff from people that are white. Thank you so much.
Rosemary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Tom, how often have you heard that in the last week or so?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, we've gotten lots of emails and phone calls along those lines. Most of the criticism has been very, very public. The support tends to be quieter and more private, which is interesting to me.
But do you think you have set the stage? And I know that, I do believe this was your intention to have a conversation about race. And I have to say, we do our small part on Radio Times. And I have to say, it's a very difficult thing to do. My approach has been that you can't, sort of like talking to kids about sex, you can't have just one conversation about sex or race. It has to be this ongoing discussion. You can do it through the arts. You can do it through history. You can do it through novels. There's so many ways to have this conversation as opposed to the, you know, grand conversation about race. Tom?
I agree. I think there are 1,000 different ways we could have done an article about race. We chose to do this one and, you know, put it out there, and then we will see where this goes. I think in part, too, that in some ways an attempt for this story was to reframe the conversation a little bit so that everyone feels like they can actually say what they think in it, because I don't think we go forward unless that people have that freedom.
Including Anna to say what she thinks?
I think she's allowed to say what she thinks, if that's what she thinks. Now, I think people are free to shout her down, explain to her why she's wrong, tell her why she's racist. I think that's all part of it. But to just sort of pretend that she doesn't exist, I don't think helps us at all.
Go ahead, Bob.
You're right, Marty, that something like this, my God, has to be ongoing. You know?
And I should say, we're three white people here talking, just right. So our listeners know. But right. Go ahead.
I mean, nobody can write in and write an article or have a radio show and be definitive about anything. And this needs to move forward. And Tom and I have been talking about this, and I've been talking to a lot of people who have contacted me, weighed in good and bad, trying to figure out, okay, what's next for me personally? What's next for me as a writer, because I want to keep going on this and do what I can to move things forward an inch, whatever that is.
Do you think, though, this article has moved things forward? I mean, what is the reaction is to frankly dump on Philadelphia Magazine, largely speaking?
Right. It's hard to know. I mean, there is a lot of anger and animosity. I went to a coffee shop I go to on Germantown Avenue. I went there a couple of days ago. The owner, who I know was coming out, and he says to me as he's coming out, they're talking about your piece in there. So I go in, the regulars, he says. So I go in, and people who sit at this one long table, it's four women, two African-American women and two white women who I know vaguely from going in there, and I wave to them. And I can, from the counter as I'm ordering my coffee, I can hear their discussion. And the words race and racial are going back and forth. And it's a very animated, though friendly conversation, clearly a dialogue. I thought for a moment, you know, maybe I'll go over and join in. But then I thought, no, just let it go. And I just stood and listened for a moment, got my to-go coffee and left. And I thought on the way out, this is exactly what the goal is, what we're looking for. There's a conversation that I wouldn't have heard even in a Germantown Avenue coffee shop a month ago. So,
see, my argument is that these conversations have gone on. I mean, I'm glad that people were talking about race, and certainly, two white women and two black women talking about race.
Right.
But my argument is that the people are doing this, whether there was a Philadelphia Magazine article or not.
I don't think they're doing it particularly publicly, and I don't think they're doing it in the context of trying to say, too, as we started this conversation about, I mean, there's large amounts of poverty in Philadelphia and large numbers of white people who just want to choose to ignore this. Mm-hmm. And I haven't heard that conversation happening very much. And hopefully that conversation can start to happen, you know, as we go forward here.
Let me see what Sean from East Falls has to say. And Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I'm a Southerner who's moved to Philadelphia, and I'm surprised by the article's generality. I mean, I definitely think taking the approach of having anonymous sources invites people to say incendiary things, whether it was white or black people, they would take that opportunity to say things, yes, that they wouldn't otherwise say, but too often it's to say unsavory things. And the other thing is just focusing the article on ethnicity or political correctness could have gotten you more information. You could have found out if the white people you interviewed knew about black ethnicity, culture, customs, and then
you could choose a focus for your piece. I mean, if your piece is really about, are whites in Philadelphia leaning more racist or less, then being explicit about that and approaching that and asking them about ethnicity, their own and African Americans, could have informed us about that, helped us see. But the anonymous approach and the poor focus, not choosing political correctness or not choosing ethnicity, it just shows an ignorance from the journalistic and the personal perspective.
Well, Sean, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give you a chance to respond to that. Do you think he's right in saying that when people are anonymous, they maybe feel emboldened to say incendiary things?
Well, I would say they feel emboldened to say what's on their mind. If somebody knows they're not going to be ID'd publicly and says something incendiary, I think they're speaking from a place of real feeling and emotion and what they believe. I take his point in that there are many approaches to how I could have talked to the people I interviewed. I kept it pretty straightforward and simple in the sense of, what is your engagement? What is your back and forth with your black neighbors? What does it look like for you?
And Sean wanted you to dig deeper. I mean, so we knew Anna, for instance, better.
Right. I think so, yeah.
I mean, do you think he has a point there?
I think he has a point. I think he wanted me to write a different article.
Yes. Well, in hindsight, do you kind of wish you had written a slightly different article or a different article?
Well, along the lines that Tom and I have talked about, in terms of people's reaction and what feels to us sometimes like a bit of a misreading of it, sure, and we could have taken maybe more caution. But I feel comfortable with the basic article I wrote and our approach, and I think it was worth going at it from the viewpoint that we did.
Sean, thanks for the call. Let's see what Richard from Chestnut Hill has to say. Richard, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. I'm a big fan of your show.
I listen to
it all the time.
Great, thanks.
I did peruse the article, and I seem to have read between the lines. I found that the mere discussion of race brings about a real direction of talking about fears. I mean, any urban environment will have people in poverty and people who are doing drugs and crime as a way of life. But, you know, the fact that you can bring it up in a forum and discuss how you feel about it, what your fears are, could then generate another discussion of how, we can remedy the situation. Any urban city is going to have crime and drugs, whether it's, you know, black and white as Philadelphia has, or it might be Hispanic or Chinese or any other, you know, urban situation. You're going to have these areas that people are going to be afraid of living with these people, you know, the people in their own neighborhoods.
Well, Richard, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, because I do think this article, Tom, is about white people's fears.
To some degree, absolutely. And, you know, he also mentioned the word remedies, and Bob ends the piece with really a challenge to white people, the ones he mentions at the beginning who are often ignoring big parts of the city, to engage more, to pay more attention, to say what they think about it. This was not meant to be a prescription for what do we do about this, but I think as a first step, engagement is probably the way to go.
And what would that engagement look like?
Well, that's a question I ask at the end of the piece. We don't know, but being more open and honest and having real conversations as a first step. And some of those conversations might not be pretty. There might be some anger and some real intense back and forth. But I feel strongly that it's certainly needed. And fear is a good word. There is a lot of fear, despite what you say, Marty, about these. You see these conversations going on. I've seen and heard a lot of fear from white people in being able to engage how they really feel and think. That's a good first step to begin to get beyond that.
And the default then is to be politically correct.
Right.
You're saying so
right.
Instead of speaking
right.
their mind
or give in to guilt
or just avoid the issue altogether.
Or avoid the issue altogether, which is probably more likely.
What do you make of Mayor Nutter's response? He wrote a long letter and called the article disgusting. He wants the Human Relations Commission, Tom, to look into it to see if it's, you know, meets the sort of incendiary criteria. What's your response to the mayor's response to this article?
Well, first of all, I think in his letter, he really mischaracterized the tone of the piece and the intention of the piece. But look, he's entitled to think what he wants about the story. What I found kind of ironic was a couple things, actually. I mean, within the letter, he asked the Human Relations Commission to investigate the issues of racial relations in Philadelphia, which was exactly the reason we did the story in the first place. But then he turns around and asks the Human Relations Commission to rebuke us for essentially having started this conversation. So I feel like there's a little bit of hypocrisy from him on that. I also, again, just find it ironic that this was Mayor Nutter, who was shouted down in council chambers a couple of weeks ago, and now wants to turn around and essentially stifle conversation about, you know, about another topic. So
where does Magazine go from here? Or is it just, you know, onto the next issue?
Well, again, I think, you know, we've spent several weeks sort of just talking about this story and have not had a lot of time to think and discuss what exactly do we do next. As I mentioned before, I'm interested in getting to a point where we can have either a conversation or an article where there's enough of a level of trust that there actually can be real dialogue, real conversation beyond what we've had already.
And we're almost out of time here, but during the break, very briefly, Bob, I said, you know, if this were the Philadelphia Daily News, there might be a different response.
I think that's right. People have talked about having trouble receiving my piece from The Messenger, Philadelphia Magazine. I get that. If it's in the Daily News, maybe there's a different response. The frustration for me is wondering, okay, are people really reading the piece, or are they starting out with the idea that Philadelphia Magazine can't write this, or if Anna the Russian is saying X, that must be what Philadelphia Magazine and the writer thinks? Well, I think that's an unfair characterization, and I want people to read the piece.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you both joined us today in Radio Times.
Thank you,
Bob
Marty.
Huber, you're very welcome.
You.
And Tom McGrath, talking about the Philadelphia Magazine cover story, being white in Philly. You can go to Radio Times' Facebook page. We started a conversation over the weekend. You can also check us out online, whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And in a slightly